It's Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret. And coming up, a Green Bay judge just dismissed a lawsuit filed this week by the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, challenging the Biden administration's plan to forgive a lot of student loan debt. We'll talk about what happened and where a will appeal could go next. Now, some people find a dish they love at a restaurant and can't stop going back again and again for it. And some home cooks decide they can't wait to get back to the restaurant and endeavor to recreate the dish in their own kitchen. That's where we are today for Food Friday. Reverse engineering someone else's recipe can be challenging, fun, or outright disastrous. Have you had this experience yourself? A favorite food item that you went home and tried to recreate? How did you fare? Let us know. 1-800-642-1234. Be honest with us. 1-800s, I'll be honest with you. 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at WPR.org. Our guest, James Shen, food editor at Taste of Home magazine, where he oversees the recipe selection as well as contributes to numerous books, special interest publications, and the Taste of Home Cooking School. Now, Taste of Home recently published the winners of a contest they ran at the end of last year where they asked home cooks to submit their favorite copycat recipes, and we bring you the winners today. James, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much for having me.
And let's start with Taste of Home's interest in doing something like this, the concept of copycat recipes. Where did this idea come from?
This has been something we've been playing around with for a number of years, and it's been around for quite a long time, ever since people probably started going to restaurants, I imagine. So we've had, we've published a number of cookbooks. One of them is still on the cookbook shelves today, or newsstand shelves today, and it is selling really, really well because people want to try to capture those things at home or the things that they can't always get when they really want to. So they're trying to make those things themselves and see what they get.
So have you tried this yourself in your kitchen, James, reverse engineering a recipe, and how did you do?
I do this all the time just because it's something fun for me to do. But in fact, I was trying to recreate something that I had at Dollywood this past summer. And she was doing this, I say Dolly like she's making this, but they do a cinnamon bread that is dunked in butter and then rolled in cinnamon and sugar and then baked, and it forms this really cinnamony, crusty, caramelized. Oh, it's so good.
Sounds like
I'm trying to recreate that at the moment.
Yeah, and how are you doing?
Not too shabby. I think I need more sugar.
More sugar, more butter. So, is there a secret to what takes place in these restaurant kitchens, what they're doing back there that makes us want to try to make it in our own kitchen?
Well, I think a lot of it is what the chefs in the restaurants do is they get the best quality ingredients they can. And then they continue to do the things, same things over and over and over again. So if you're going to like an Olive Garden or someplace like that, consistency is the key because you want that same thing to taste the same as it is in Bangor, Maine, as it is in San Diego, California. So we've got to be consistent there. But the other restaurants, they're like they get the highest quality ingredients they can, and then they perfect it and they season and they taste, which is something we should be doing all the time.
So they get a lot more opportunities to make mistakes than we do in our own kitchen. That's the way it sounds to me.
Right. The people there are, that's what they do for a living. Yeah. They sit there and they play with the food and they try it over and over and over again. Whereas we're not going to want to do that. We just want to make something, serve it to our family and move on.
So I'm getting some questions here from our Central Time team, and they want to know, once you perfect this Dollywood cinnamon bread recipe, where will we be able to find it?
Well, if I have my way, it's going to be in our next copycat cookbook, which I believe is coming out mid part of next year. But we'll also probably put it online as well.
Is there going to be a theme? Yeah, is there going to be a theme to this next copycat recipe book?
Nope, we're just going with generic, general restaurant copycats. It worked for us once, and we're going to do it again because people are clamoring for more, and we just... Anytime we put a copycat recipe up on our website, people go crazy for it, whether it's Panera, Olive Garden, amusement parks like Dollywood or Busch Gardens. They love it.
So are the restaurants themselves aware of what you're doing? Do you get their blessing in some way?
We don't get their blessing so much. So like we don't ask them. We just do it. And they're aware that we are doing it along as, with everybody else. There's a lot of bloggers who are trying to recreate all this stuff, too. And I think that for the most part, they're happy that we're doing this because it gives them free publicity. And then people are like, hey, I see this recipe for a fried lasagna. but let me go into the restaurant and try it there first and see if I can recreate that. And then, I've never had anybody come back and say, no, you need to take that recipe down. That is ours.
Mm-hmm.
One, because you can't copyright a recipe. You can copyright the title, so we can change that. But the recipe itself, especially if we're going by, it's inspired by, and we didn't actually take their recipe, and then we're all fine and dandy, and they're thrilled to death.
James Shen, food editor of Taste of Home, and you enlisted the support of your readers and your fans to bring you their copycat recipes, and give us some idea of the scope of the kind of recipes you received in this contest.
Oh, it was amazing. We received, I can't remember exactly, it was like over 700 different recipes, everything from breakfast to desserts and everything in between. So it was a little bit of a challenge to kind of dig through all this stuff and figure out what is going to be our top 12 winners. And we had a whole lot of fun testing them out, and I think we came up with some really good ones.
Yeah, and so what's the taste test like? Do you go to the restaurant and then come back to your test kitchen? And how did the process of picking these winners, which had to be next to impossible, go about?
So a lot of it, everyone that is involved in the taste testing has tasted these things before, so we know what we're going up against, and so we just tasted everything, and we're like, you know what, that's pretty darn close. And there's only a few things here and there that it's like, well, I'm not exactly sure what's missing, but it's pretty darn close, so we're going to forgive that.
Grant emailed us at ideas@WPR.org to ask the simple question, has the KFC chicken recipe ever been cracked?
If you ask KFC, they'll say no.
Inspired by KFC. How about that, James Shen?
Exactly. Inspired by the 11 herbs and spices that they use. I think that's their catch line. But I think we've got a couple of recipes that I think get you really darn close. And I believe even in this one contest, we had someone submit a recipe for KFC's coleslaw. or inspired by KFC's coleslaw. And that actually came in our first place spot, but it wasn't our grand prize winner.
Who was the grand prize winner in this contest, James Shen?
So this one is from Jolene Martinelli. She's in Fremont, New Hampshire, and she recreated Olive Garden's fried lasagna.
Yes.
So it's like they took lasagna and recrafted it, wrapped all the filling around the noodle, or wrapped the noodles around the filling, breaded it, and then deep fried it. I'm like, how good does that sound?
So here's the good news. We've got the recipe available for you, courtesy of Taste of Home and our guest James Shen, online right now at WPR.org/Food Friday. So if you were just thinking about what's for dinner tonight, how about a menu inspired by Olive Garden's fried lasagna? What's the trick to this? Is there a trick to this, or is it just a process?
It's just a process. I mean, the reader that submitted this, Jolene, did a very good job of explaining what she did and why she did things. And if you just kind of follow it along, it works really, really well. I was surprised because I'm reading this the first time, and I'm like, that's going to fall apart. I mean, that's just going to kind of like mush down, and it doesn't. It works really, really well. But you just have to kind of keep things in mind, like what is the next step? And so it works well.
Well, if you don't have a deep fryer, are there other ways to go about finishing the recipe inspired by Olive Garden's fried lasagna, James?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't have a deep fryer at home either. I just take a cast iron skillet and fill it with about an inch of oil, and that works perfectly. If you don't have that, a Dutch oven, like a high-sided stock pot, Dutch oven, something like that will also work just fine.
What about an air fryer?
I think you could. I'm like, I would spray it really liberally with like cooking spray or olive oil and stuff like that. But I think an air fryer would work really well.
That is just this.
I'm gonna have to give that one a shot.
Yeah, I'm very curious about all of this. I did try one of these recipes, and we'll tell you all about it. But I also want to invite you to participate with us and share your stories of trying to recreate your favorite recipes from your favorite restaurants once you make it back to your own kitchen and how you fared. Some things on social media got to just have to make you chuckle a little bit. But if you've got the story, or if you've got KFC's, inspired by KFC's chicken, We bring that as well. What have you figured out from your favorite restaurants? 1-800-642-1234 to join our conversation. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us, like Grant did, ideas@WPR.org, with your food-inspired stories. And we'll continue with our guest, James Shen from Taste of Home, next on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're picking up our Food Friday talk with James Shen, food editor of Taste of Home. And we're talking about figuring out the recipes inspired by dishes at your favorite restaurants or amusement parks or sports venues. Why not? What have you tried at home? 1-800-642-1234. And how did it go? 800-642-1234 or ideas@WPR.org. Now, the recipes we're talking about today can be found on our website at WPR.org/Food Friday. And we brought up the inspired by Olive Garden's fried lasagna recipe. But the one I tried, James, and the one that I made a lot of friends with, was the recipe inspired by Humphrey Slocum's Secret Breakfast. Now, I wasn't even familiar with Humphrey Slocum.
Yeah, it is a fun little ice cream shop. They're based out in San Francisco, so I knew about them really well just because I lived there for about 12 years. But they have some really fun and unique flavors, and one of them is this, it's a secret breakfast is what they call it. But it's basically a bourbon-flavored ice cream that has caramelized cornflakes in it.
Oh, yes. Treating those cornflakes with heavy cream, sugar, and butter, and then cooking them a little bit so they're a little bit crisp, and then creating a custard ice cream that is just to die for on its own, adding a little bit of bourbon to it, and you get a taste that is just one of a kind and, you know, was pretty popular around the office.
It is. It's a really phenomenal flavor. I was floored on many aspects of it. One, the ice cream by itself, just without the cornflakes, is phenomenal. It's like it's got a nice hit of bourbon, but not overpowering. It's got a really nice mouthfeel. It's very rich. But then you add in those cornflakes. And what surprised me about it is they stay crunchy.
Yes.
And I'm like, because a lot of times you throw things into ice cream and it softens up and it's really disappointing. But this one, the cornflakes stay crunchy.
Well, that's what cereal's supposed to do, isn't it? And after I gave it to one of our members at Audience Services here at Wisconsin Public Radio, she immediately went off on all the different sorts of cereals you could throw in there. You'd take that ice cream, and just about any sugared cereal would probably be a little something to try.
I like how she thinks.
Cinnamon Toast Crunch was what she came up with, and maybe not with the bourbon. And the other thing I'd mention is on your website, the Taste of Home website, James, there is one comment from that recipe that says, too much bourbon. I did not get that complaint once when I passed the ice cream around. Just for the record, I would stick to the recipe.
Yeah, I saw that, and I'm just like, okay, you're going to have to go back in and give a review of that one just to kind of counteract hers, because I'm like, I don't know what she's thinking about. It's like, I think it's just the perfect amount of bourbon.
I do as well, and so did everybody else that tried it, and you can find that recipe. Now, I didn't have an ice cream maker, but fortunately, my sister did, and I will say, since I made this ice cream, my sister still doesn't have an ice cream maker. I have held on to that. It was just too much fun, and it was just too tasty, James Shen. There's so many different things that you can try with it. I really, really appreciated that recipe. The one that I thought that was most daunting of your recipes, though, was the the recipe inspired by the Cheesecake Factory's Celebration Cheesecake. This is 7 layers.
This is a monster of a cake,
and
it's very, you look at it and you're like, oh, it's intimidating.
Yes.
It is 7 layers, and there's a lot going on. There's cake, there's ice cream, there's frosting, you name it, it's in there, and it's all covered in sprinkles. But what I love about this is the contributor, Christine, simplified it. She did a lot of things to make it a little bit easier. Like, she uses cake mix, she uses instant chocolate pudding, freeze-dried, cheesecake filling. So there's only 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, about less than 10 ingredients in this thing for something that looks so daunting. But it is amazing, and it's a showstopper.
Yeah, and the person that had submitted this recipe, I think it was for her children who were born 5 years apart, but on the same day. So it would be cause for a big celebration. And when you look at this cake, the first thing I'd think is, I don't think I can make that. But then when you go down the recipe list, you think, well, 7 layers, 10 ingredients, I've got a shot.
Yeah. No, we were floored when we got it into our test kitchen, and we're like, this is going to be odd, but let's give it a shot. And it works. It works so well. And it's something that a lot of like beginner cooks can even try, because you're not looking at like making a cake from scratch. You're not looking at making a pudding or a custard or a cheesecake filling from scratch. Everything is pretty much done for you. So you're kind of just customizing and tweaking and assembling it yourself.
Right. You're the manufacturer of the product, basically, and you've got all the parts and pieces right there, courtesy of the recipe that, again, is available, WPR.org/Food Fridays, courtesy of our guest, James Shen, food editor at Taste of Home. And you know, since you got the kitchen to do this and you've got the kitchen to make the mistakes, I want to know from you, James, what advice do you have for a home cook who might be interested in trying this with a dish they love at a restaurant?
So the easiest way that I like to like start with is like, if you go to a restaurant and you try something and you're like, okay, what is it close to? And it's like, so if you go to like Panera and you're getting their broccoli cheese soup, The easiest thing to do is start with the broccoli cheese soup you already know works. So whether it's one of ours or somebody else's, then you're like, okay, let me try that. And then how close can I get to that? What is missing? And then it's a lot easier if you enlist other people to help you, because if your palate isn't the greatest, or you may miss something, like, I don't know what the flavor of tarragon tastes like, so I may not get that one ingredient right, but someone else might know. So, and then it's just a matter of just dialing it in, like, what is, like, this herb is too strong, we don't have enough of this, the salt level's too high, it needs a little bit of acid, something like that. And it's just a matter of trial and error, doing it 2, 3, 4 times, and then you can finally dial it down into exactly what it is, or close to what the original version is.
James, did you have a favorite from the winner's list that we haven't talked about already?
The bourbon ice cream one, like, floored me. I love that one. But honestly, I'm a sucker for the coleslaw on the KFC coleslaw.
The KFC coleslaw.
I was like, you know what? They did a very, very good job, because I'm like, well, how big is the difference can that be? And I'm like, no, they did it really, really well. And then
so what was the secret to that KFC, the recipe inspired by the KFC coleslaw?
So they did a good job of like getting the texture right. There's a nice balance of sugar to acid. So they've got both sugar, lemon juice, and vinegar. So they're combining two acids. So the lemon juice and the vinegar, I think what was missing, because I was always usually using one or the other.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like when they put this together, I'm like, yep, that's it right there. And then I think the other thing that I was missing out of mine is a little bit of grated onion, which is what this reader put in. And then a little bit of buttermilk is also another interesting idea that is not in a whole lot of coleslaws.
Yeah, so I would not have.
A number of things that she put together and came up with a winner.
Yeah, that'll be something I'll have to try myself. And do you have a favorite submission that didn't make the winner's list, James?
Yeah, but I probably shouldn't say. I don't want to disappoint everyone.
Sorry, you didn't win this time. So as you continue to develop these recipes, one of the thoughts I had is it's just richer at the restaurant. Is that just my experience at the restaurant, or is it richer at the restaurant? Is there more butter? Is there more sugar? Is there more salt?
Yes, there is. because a lot of times people get scared when they're at the home and they're like, I know how much salt is going in here. I don't want to like make it too salty. Plus, I also know what my cardiologist is saying, so I'm going to cut back on that. Where the restaurant, they don't have that limitation. And instead, you may use milk, like 2% or whole milk in your home, but the restaurant may grab half and half and heavy cream. So it's like, yeah, they're going to go a little bit more. And but you'll also know you're going to pay a little bit more for that as well. But I also think that food tastes a little bit better when someone else is making it for you.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was thinking too. But also, that is it richer in their kitchens? And the reason I asked this is when I tried the recipe inspired by the Humphrey Slocum secret breakfast ice cream, the thing that I found most often is I saw what was going into it and I thought, well, that is not going to be very healthy. Where I could just grab a quick pint of ice cream and not think twice about what went into it, James.
Right, but if you look at the package of ice cream, the nutritional analysis is spot on to what this one is. So it's like you're not getting any healthier by buying it.
Well, and the other thing was, I thought the cost of the ingredients was comparable to what I'd pay for at the, if not a little bit more than what I'd pay for a pint of commercial ice cream at the grocery store.
Yeah, I mean, if you start looking at what those higher end like craft ice creams are nowadays, you're getting into $7-$8 a pint now.
Yeah.
And I just looked this past weekend and I'm like, I'm not paying $8 for a pint of ice cream here. And this recipe will come in way under that.
Well, I was going to say, I brought my ice cream to a party this weekend. And when I was sharing it with others, I explained, I thought it was maybe potentially more expensive than the ice cream at the store. And somebody said, well, the ice cream at the store has more air in it. I hadn't even thought of air in ice cream.
Well, and that's why homemade ice cream is much more richer and you get that really creamy mouthfeel, because like that your friend said, it's like when you're commercially making this, especially the cheaper the ice cream is, the more air is inside it. And they whip it up and get the air bubbles trapped in there. And so you'll notice if you take a scoop of that and then a scoop of this particular one, the mouthfeel is going to be totally different. Even though there may have the same ingredients in there, if you've got a lot of air in there, it's just not going to taste the same.
And that's why James Shen, my sister, still does not have her ice cream maker back. Thank you. We're out of time, but thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. Oh, well, yeah, or I could get myself one and give her back her old one. Either way, I want to thank you for these recipes and remind folks that they can find them online at WPR.org/Food Friday or from our guest, James Shen, food editor at Taste of Home. James, thanks again.
Thank you very much. You have a good weekend.
You as well. And a reminder that coming up tomorrow, Monday, it's Friday. Join Kate Archer Kent Monday on the morning show for your State Capitol Report when Kate talks with the state's International Agribusiness Center on which exports are doing well and where they're headed and the forecast of a sharp slowdown in global trade ahead. That's coming up on the morning show Monday from 7 to 9 right here on the Ideas Network. Allegations of cheating have recently rocked the worlds of competitive chess, poker, and fishing. Following last month's Great Wisconsin Quilt Show in Madison, will you be adding quilting to that list? According to their website, this year's winner for Best in Show was a ringer. And it is an absolute beaut with a geometric and symmetrical sunburst of rich reds, purples, yellows, and blues that jump right off the fabric. But the initial winner will have to relinquish their Best in Show ribbon and $1,500 cash prize because this very same quilt was allegedly competing in the Great Wisconsin Quilt Show way back in 2018. Now, there are rules, and one is that you just can't keep entering your quilt in contests until it wins something. And this isn't necessarily cheating, as the quilt show says. It was their mistake, and they accept full responsibility. No, the controversy may be the new Best in Show winner at this year's Great Wisconsin Quilt Show's not from Wisconsin at all. They're from Illinois, which all the rules allow. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret. And Wisconsin candidates for the U.S. Senate are set to debate tonight, and you can hear it live right here. The Wisconsin Broadcasters Association debate starts at 7. Listen to an hour of the candidates, plus analysis after it wraps, right here on the Ideas Network and online at WPR.org. Now, the Biden administration is facing several legal challenges over its proposal to forgive certain student loan debts. This week, the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty added another lawsuit on behalf of the Brown County Taxpayers Association. Just yesterday, a federal judge in Green Bay dismissed that suit. We're going to get into the plaintiff's arguments, where the suit goes from here, and then later dissect some of the constitutional issues surrounding the debt consolidation plan. And if you'd like to join us, we invite you to the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Our guest is Rick Essenberg, president of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. And Rick, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, what was the reason that the Brown County Taxpayers Association filed suit against the president's student debt relief proposal?
Well, what the president has done here is really extraordinary. He has undertaken to wipe out about $1 trillion worth of student debt, adding to the national deficit, without clear congressional authorization. This is a blatant violation of our separation of powers. And it's something that I think the courts need to look at. Now, the problem has been that while a layperson listening to your radio show might think, well, when the president does something that spends money unlawfully, then taxpayers should be able to go to court and sue and have the rightness or wrongness of that adjudicated. But federal courts have been very, very reluctant to ever grant taxpayers standing. They have required a different type of injury to litigants. And so there have been other people who have brought lawsuits. They have tried creative ways around this standing problem. But each time that this has happened, these cases have been filed, the administration has changed the program in order to defeat the standing of the challengers. They do not want to have to defend this action in court because their legal arguments are very, very weak. So we decided to go at it directly, and we're relying on what we admit are some older cases, which recognized certain types of taxpayer standing to challenge a constitutional impropriety in a spending or taxing provision itself. We fully admit that we are asking the law to be used in ways that it hasn't been used recently, but we think in the context of a $1 trillion program, it's very important to the people of this country to have the legality of that program assessed by the courts.
So when Rick,
we're not surprised that Judge Griesbach said, "Look, you got to if you're going to succeed here, you got to take it up to a higher court. It's not something that I can do as a trial judge."
So this is about taxpayers having standing, and generally from a layperson's perspective, Rick Essenberg, is this because the taxpayers haven't actually paid any money towards this yet, so they don't have standing? Do they have to wait until it becomes a cost for the taxpayer to have a place in the courts for this?
No, it's not that. It's that the federal courts have been reluctant to recognize that type of injury. And so it's in contrast to state courts, where here in Wisconsin, we do have relatively broad taxpayer standing, but federal courts have been somewhat more restrictive. But
so,
it's not a question of whether or not the taxes have been paid already. It's really a question of assessing the type of injury that the plaintiff claims to have suffered.
If you're, and it sounds like you are planning to appeal, correct? The
absolutely.
Okay.
And we've already filed an appeal.
All right. So you are appealing. And in the event that you were successful in your appeal, could this change legal precedent about taxpayer standing in federal lawsuits going forward?
Well, we think it would, but only in the narrowest of circumstances, where it would in a case where the challenge is to the action which itself mandated the spending of money or the taxation of money. It's not simply a question of taxpayers not approving of what the government was doing with their money. We also feel that, and we've also argued that the part of the problem here, and sort of borrowing from the West Virginia versus EPA decision last year, that this is really a major question. I mean, this is not something that is sort of a minor dispute about a relatively small amount of money. I mean, this is a huge amount of money. This is a very, very significant unilateral action by the president. One of the things I would caution your listeners is not to form their position with respect to lawsuits like this simply on whether they like student loan forgiveness or not.
You're making a legal argument here, and a legal standing argument, and the role that the president would play, whether it's a unitary executive or still needs some support from the legislature. If the legislature were to support student debt relief and the president were to sign it into law, would the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty have any opportunity to sue?
No, we wouldn't bring the case because, the point is not whether student loans should be forgiven or not. I don't think this is a particularly good use of $1 trillion. I think that there's a lot better ways in which that money can be used. But certainly Congress would have the authority to forgive these loans. But it is Congress that has the authority, and not the president acting unilaterally.
Rick Essenberg, president of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, joining us. And Rick, one of the arguments I've heard in the president on the president's behalf would be the HEROES Act of 2003, which, as I understand it, provides some authority to the federal government to modify federal student loan programs during national emergencies. And that might include canceling federal student loan debt, or is that... does that give the president any protection as you see it?
Well, no, I don't think so. And of course, neither did the Justice Department until right before the president announced it. It changed its position. The problem is this: the HEROES Act was designed to allow targeted student loan forgiveness for military people and first responders. It was passed in the wake of 9/11, where we knew that there were people who were going to be deployed in various ways, and we didn't want them to default on their student loan. Here you've got a situation where the president is simply saying, well, there was something that happened here that may have made it harder to pay these student loans. They didn't have to actually pay them because we suspended repayment. It's not ongoing now because I've declared that the COVID pandemic to be over. And so it's really an extraordinary expansion that really, I think, goes well beyond what the HEROES Act ever intended. And, last year in the West Virginia case, the Supreme Court made clear that our constitutional separation of powers requires that at least for major questions, and this is a major question, there needs to be clear congressional authorization for executive action. The Congress does not, as the saying goes, hide mountains and molehills. And the notion that something that was passed to accommodate the specific interest of first responders in the wake of a terrorist attack can now be used to allow the president to forgive student loans every time he thinks something that has happened that makes them harder to pay, I think would be a usurpation of the legislative power by the president, and something that nobody should want to permit. Because, even if you love Joe Biden and you love this program and you love the things that he's doing, I guarantee you that at some point in the future, there will be a president who you do not like and who you will not want to have this type of power.
Would you take this case all the way to the Supreme Court? So you would continue to appeal until you get to the very end of our justice system here.
I think that's probably where this is. If this is salient, that's probably where it's going to go.
What about the lawsuit from the six Republican attorneys general, state's attorneys general?
Well, this is an instance where, they tried to work around this standing problem by saying that, look, we have state student loan servicing agencies that are servicing these loans. If you reduce the amount of the loans, those servicing agencies will make less money. And so therefore we are harmed in a way which goes beyond our status as taxpayers or simply as states. And in response to that, the administration said, okay, we're not going to forgive the loans for the people who are whose debt is being serviced by you, and which is a quite cynical thing, right? Having said that there is this national emergency that requires student loan debt forgiveness for people who meet these certain criteria, it is decided to throw these people under the bus, these people who are having their loans serviced by these six states, in order to prevent the legality of this program from being assessed by a court.
Rick, thanks as always for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you. Take care.
Rick Essenberg, president of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, talking with him about his organization's legal challenge to a federal student loan forgiveness program and the dismissal of which they are planning to appeal all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court if necessary. Coming up, we analyze these and some other constitutional arguments facing student debt cancellation, and we invite you to the conversation as well at 1-800-642-1234. We'll continue here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're continuing our talk about legal challenges for the Biden administration's plan to forgive certain student loan debt. And joining us now is Eric Casper, professor of political science and pre-law advisor at UW-Eau Claire, where he's also director of the Menard Center for Constitutional Studies. Eric, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
And if you would, start by sharing with us why the judge in Green Bay, a federal judge, dismissed Will's lawsuit yesterday, the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty.
Yeah, well, if you look at the lawsuit itself, one of the preliminary questions is, do the plaintiffs have standing? And as a general matter, as with the U.S. Constitution, there would need to be, under Article 3 of the Constitution, there would have to be an actual case or controversy, according to the language of Article 3, which includes this requirement then of parties having standing. And so the question is, what is the harm that would be caused? And as was discussed a little bit here earlier in the hour, there are these precedents from the U.S. Supreme Court on taxpayer standing. And the traditional approach from the court back to a case called Frothingham versus Mellon in 1923 is that taxpayers generally do not have standing, and in part because the courts are afraid of, if every question about budgets were then brought into the courts to be litigated constitutionally, that it would overwhelm the courts. There's a major exception that's been found to that over the years, which is that Supreme Court, going back to the 1960s, has found that if their taxpayers are challenging money spent by the government on religious purposes, that under the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment, they can achieve standing. But Supreme Court has been reluctant to expand taxpayer standing to other areas over the years.
And as we heard from the president of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, that he would be willing to take this case all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, which is, I would understand it, Eric, could create some new legal precedent. And what would that legal precedent look like were the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty to be successful in their lawsuit?
Well, it depends. If the U.S. Supreme Court decided to revisit some of its case law on taxpayer standing to open up, so to speak, the ability of someone to file a lawsuit as a taxpayer based on their view that the U.S. Constitution is being violated by the spending, it would depend how much they wanted to open it up. They could potentially lay down a rule that makes it so that you could see quite a number of challenges, or they could open it up to just, one other area like they did with the Establishment Clause and allowing taxpayer standing there. In recent years, the majority on the Supreme Court has not sent a signal in any cases that I'm aware of that they want to see taxpayer standing opened up in that way. And if anything, more recent cases in recent decades from the Supreme Court suggests that if they're going to move in any direction on taxpayer standing at the federal level, it may be to close it up even more. It remains to be seen if they take this case or if they take a number of these cases that are in the courts right now, they could change direction on that question.
Eric Casper, our guest, professor of political science and pre-law advisor at UW-Eau Claire, where he is also the director of the Menard Center for Constitutional Studies. And I want to move past this idea of standing for a moment to get to the question of congressional delegation of authority. I'd asked Rick Essenberg about the HEROES Act of 2003 and what cover that may provide for the president's plan for student debt relief. Where does the constitutional law put us here?
Yeah, so assuming that you can get past the hurdle of standing, and as you mentioned earlier in the program, there are, in terms of what we see in other states in some of these other lawsuits, there are others who are filing lawsuits besides taxpayers. And so even if we don't change the law in terms of taxpayer standing, this case can get potentially into court based on other plaintiffs. I mean, the big question here is, or at least the next big question, is the delegation of authority from Congress to the executive branch. And there is a quite a bit of case law going back two centuries where the Supreme Court has said that Congress does have the ability to delegate some of its authority as long as they provide enough details and they're clear and specific enough with the goals and there are intelligible principles that will guide, in particular, the executive branch of how to exercise that authority. The question here with the HEROES Act then is how do we interpret the language in that act that says this can be done in terms of waiving or modifying the applicable provisions related to student aid programs in the case of a national emergency? What is a national emergency? And that's what, you know, the two parties would be, assuming that we get to the merits of the case, the two parties would be arguing in court whether or not there has been a national emergency as contemplated by the HEROES Act that would allow the executive branch to exercise this power.
Let's go to the phones here at 1-800-642-1234, where Jerry in Illinois is standing by. Jerry, you're on the air with Eric Casper.
Eric, Jerry Podrazzo, Democratic candidate for Illinois 45th Senate District. My youngsters went to university. My mom provided a Illinois self-funded scholarship, kind of the same kind of program as Wisconsin. I don't have an issue about this because I hear these attorneys tripping all over themselves with this constitutional noise. Here's the bottom line on this, I feel. For 10 years, if you look back at your checking account statement, your credit card statement, your savings account statement, we were getting paid 0.25%, 0.5% on those investments for years. The credit card statements were skyrocketing, 18-20%. The individuals that had student loans during that time were paying a high interest.
And I appreciate the call, Jerry. We're short on time, but that doesn't seem to have entered into the debate or at least legal discussion of what's happening here, Eric.
Well, I think it's important to point out the distinction between, you know, the policy question, does what happens here, is it good or bad policy versus is it constitutional? And I mean, that, as I was pointed out earlier in the hour, if Congress were to pass something that the president signed into law to do this exact same thing, then that delegation of power question wouldn't be there. This is really the only question is, if Congress doesn't act to do something, can the executive branch now act on its own to do this? But I mean, to the caller's point, you know, with those real concerns about student debt that have arisen over the years, I mean, that in and of itself could be reason for Congress to take action. But if Congress doesn't take action, then what is constitutional for the executive branch to do without Congress doing something new? They would have to rely on some sort of authority here that's been delegated by Congress in the past.
And Eric, going back to the HEROES Act for a moment, which has been used at least by some legal scholars as a cover for the president's proposal for some student debt relief, how have the courts seen the scope of the HEROES Act and what it can and can't do?
Well, I'm not aware of application here to this specific question in terms of you know, what we're looking at in terms of this type of student debt relief. I mean, I can tell you that, you know, the definition of a national emergency, it's like a lot of other terms that get used in the law. You know, if you could define that, I think, as the way the plaintiffs in this lawsuit are defining it, this is not the equivalent of some sort of post 9/11 or kind of wartime situation. But because the language does have a little bit of subjectivity in it, I'm sure that, you know, the government on the defense on this lawsuit would point to the fact that, you know, the COVID-19 pandemic was quite an unprecedented period of time, and that you saw a major disruption to our, you know, our way of life and to people's employment and their finances in many cases. And so that's why they're making the argument, and we're seeing this in some of the lower courts now and other places around the country, that it does fit that notion of a national emergency.
Hey, Eric, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me.
Eric Casper is professor of political science and pre-law advisor at UW-Eau Claire, where he's also director of the Menard Center for Constitutional Studies. We talked with him about the dismissal of Will's lawsuit challenging the Biden administration's student loan debt forgiveness plan and what sort of legal standing the president might have to get that plan pushed through. And we also looked at some of the constitutional challenges that the plan's been facing. I want to invite you to continue the conversation all weekend long, if you like, on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can email us anytime, ideas@WPR.org. And let us know what you think about the president's proposal, what taxpayers standing have, what taxpayers have in terms of standing in the courts, and whether or not you can see the constitutional arguments being made for and against and the potential consequences of what could come with new legal precedents as a result of this case. Coming up Monday on Central Time, it is one game at a time for some Packer fans. Those who are in recovery or those who just want to avoid the alcohol-imbued insanity now have a place to call their own at Lambeau Field. And you can find out about Section Yellow Monday on Central Time from 3 until 6. And now that the president's pardoned everyone convicted on federal charges of simple marijuana possession, will Wisconsin be reweighing the costs and benefits of legalizing weed? Join Rob Ferret, who returns Monday on Central Time from 3 until 6. Coming up after the news, we'll take a look at the problems with polling ahead of the 2022 midterms. They are 31 days away. But are there some discrepancies in our expectations? We'll explain. I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Rob Ferret today, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
Live from NPR News.